Salve and salutations. My name is Charles Chestnut. This is Storied History, and this story is finally about the Mexican Revolution. I have been wanting to do this one for a while. In fact, that's why I started researching Mexico in the first place. And as those of you who have been listening for the last year or so, and thank you for that, as you will know, I started doing the research for this one because I wanted to learn about Pancho Villa, which then involved learning about the Mexican Revolution, but trying to understand it in a vacuum was basically impossible. You can't understand why it happened until you understand why it happened. So you have to learn about what came before, and then what came before that. So I went back further and further and eventually ended up at the beginning, starting with the Aztecs and the Mayans centuries before. But we are finally here, and I finally understand the Mexican Revolution. Sort of. Probably. Possibly. It is definitely probably possible. And more importantly, I found the story. And it's a cool story. Actually, it's a series of stories that is kind of interwoven with some really fascinating individuals. You've got the bandit king turned revolutionary. You've got the mystic who thought the spirit spoke to him and told him that he would change the course of Mexican history, which he did. And then you've got the true revolutionary who just wanted land reform. And every good story needs a good villain, and we've got two of them, possibly three. Two definite bad guys and one lesser bad guy, although still a bastard. So this is how it's going to work. I'm going to cover the Mexican Revolution by explaining what three people were doing. Three of the most important figures. Pancho Villa, Emiliano Zapata, and Francisco Madero. And how they all came together to change everything in Mexico. This is not going to be short. In total, it's going to be three episodes. I'm going to be trying to do all of these in one go, and they will be released over time. I thought about trying to tell the stories of the individuals in separate episodes, having one episode for Pancho Villa, one for Zapata, one for Madero, but I don't think that's going to work. I think that's not the most entertaining way to do it, to tell the story, or the most coherent. And so, because this is storied history, we're going to go for the story in the history. Before we do, though, I want to make one thing clear. This is kind of context that really you have to understand this or it doesn't all make sense about why this happened. Okay, Mexico is mountainous. It is as mountainous as Switzerland is. Mexican states are isolated, especially back then. The terrain means that the farmland is very rare and incredibly valuable. It also means that transportation is limited and difficult. Mountain passes are easily blocked, and if you block one mountain pass, the right mountain pass, you can cut off massive parts of the country from the rest. It's not like if you cut off one mountain road, you can go to the next mountain over and cross another road. They're very rare. So this isolation leads to local areas having huge amounts of autonomy from the centralized power centers, meaning Mexico City. It's why the local areas had warlords and hacienda owners had such extreme power. And it's also why it was very difficult to put these things down, because once you have a region that is acting independently, it's hard to get in there and stop them. Okay, so I did cover the backdrop for all this in a previous episode, the one about Porfirio Diaz, the dictator of Mexico. So let me explain. No, there is too much. Let me sum up. He was incredibly oppressive. He ground the faces of the poor to serve the very wealthy and to serve foreign interests, specifically and primarily the United States. The extreme levels of abuse and blatant corruption enforced by very, very violent actions on behalf of the government is what led directly to the revolution. On a side note, I have learned since my last podcast about Diaz that one of the descendants of Porfirio Diaz lives in my neighborhood. She is directly, albeit a little bit distantly, related to Diaz. Seriously, she is descended from the strong man of the Americas. She and her husband own a wonderful po' boy shop here in New Orleans called Killer Po' Boys, a po' boy being a type of sandwich. Killer Po' Boys is very good. Now, I don't think that they are trying to use that po' boy shop to reestablish the dictatorship of Mexico, but I can't be certain because they are really good. So I'm going to keep an eye on them from now on. Terry, that joke was for you. Thank you for listening. Moving to more serious matters, comets and superstitious panic therein. Specifically, Halley's Comet. All right, so comets have been used to predict calamities, disasters, the death of kings, many other big events and small events throughout the world. It's just superstition, but it is fairly widespread. Halley's Comet is no exception. In 1066, it was thought to have predicted the Norman conquest of England. Reportedly, although perhaps not actually, there was a comet in the sky a few days or perhaps the night before Montezuma's fall. But we actually covered that long ago. Halley's Comet was coming back in 1910. Now, this is a weird and I find amusing little intersection of superstition and science, because it was good and accurate science that allowed the real prediction of when Halley's Comet would appear. Newton's laws of planetary motion were used by Sir Edmund Halley to understand what comets were and to correctly predict when Halley's Comet would appear. That is why it's called Halley's Comet, after Sir Edmund Halley. And his predictions were correct. And they continue to be correct. But it was that accurate prediction that caused the panic before the actual comet arrived. So it's a little odd. The general public, kind of the uneducated, the slightly ignorant, were listening to the scientists saying, hey, there's going to be a comet in April. But they were not listening to the scientists saying, hey, everything's going to be fine. It's not going to destroy the world. It's selective listening and belief, I suppose. So leading up to the comet of 1910, there were reports that the entire Earth, as it passed through the tail of Halley's Comet, was going to be subjected to waves of poison gas. Or that the comet will actually strike the Earth, causing a massive explosion. Everybody dies. Or that it will actually strike the ocean, causing massive tidal waves, destroying every city on every coast in the world, and everyone was going to die. In China, the comet was thought to herald the end of the dynasty that would actually end up lasting for another several months. People in Europe were buying anti-comet pills. Take the pill and the comet won't kill you. And anti-comet umbrellas. Really? Anti-comet umbrellas. That is just a new level of stupidity. Here in America, Mark Twain died while the comet was in the sky. In Mexico, people were panicking about the poison gas, and so all of the churches opened their doors and told the general populace that if there was poison gas, the poison gas would not be able to get into the church or possibly would be neutralized upon entry. Sure, I guess. So April comes around, and as the comet falls towards the sun, the ice that actually makes up the comet starts to heat up. It vaporizes. It forms the tail, the vaporized water, which is then illuminated by the sun itself. That's why comets look the way they do. On April 10th, it becomes visible. And over the next week or so, it got closer and closer and brighter and brighter. The brightest portion was on May 19th. And on that day, in Mexico, all of the churches opened their doors and all of the people crowded in, praying for their own salvation. And at 9 a.m. Mexican time, the Earth actually did pass through the tail of the comet. And as it did, nothing happened. Nothing at all. Not in Mexico and not in anywhere else. The world moved on. And the people, rather sheepishly, went back to their lives. But in Mexico, after the comet, the real disaster was yet to come. and that had been building for several decades. Porfirio Diaz. Diaz was stability. Diaz was progress. Diaz was a dictator. And the chickens were going to come home to roost. And the primary movers and shakers, or at least the ones that I'm going to focus on, were Pancho Villa, Emiliano Zapata, and Francisco Madero. I'm going to talk about who they are before talking about what they did, and how they ended up interacting with each other, and how they shaped and changed the entire course of Mexican history. So, the comet is gone. Let's meet our stars. Pancho was a bandit boy. His horse was fast as polished steel. He wore his gun outside his pants for all the honest world to feel. Now Pancho met his match, you know, on the deserts down in Mexico. Nobody heard his dying words. But that's the way it goes. That is from a song called The Ballad of Pancho and Lefty. It's not actually about Pancho Villa, although it could be, loosely, but it is not officially. I do love the song, and I thank you for tolerating my not polished singing voice. I'm a better speaker than I am a singer. So the beginning of that song is actually accurate for Pancho. Pancho was a bandit, and his horse was fast as polished steel. He wore his gun outside his pants for all the honest world to feel. Pancho Villa was born José Dorotío Arango Arámbula, and I apologize for mispronouncing that. He was the oldest of five children. He quit school to help his mother after his father died. He was a sharecropper, a mule skinner, a butcher, a bricklayer. And he actually, as a young teenager, ended up working for one of the U.S. railway companies. Because if you remember from the earlier episodes, the only real investment in the country was coming from outside sources. And the U.S. railways were some of them. So José, as he was known back then, moves away from home when he's 16. But he ends up coming back because he had to track down and kill the owner of the hacienda who had raped his sister. He then becomes a bandit and changed his name to Arango. Before that, he was a law-abiding citizen. Mostly, you know, within reason, up to that point. But after he kills the hacienda owner, there's really nowhere to go from there. So he roams the hills as a thief and becomes a member of a bandit gang. He was arrested in 1898 for gun and mule theft. And a few years go by before he's arrested again. The second time, he was arrested for having stolen property. Well, did he just have the stolen property, or did he just have it because he had just stolen it? We don't know. It doesn't matter. Because what happened to him is what happened to some of the violent banditos back then. Instead of actually giving him the death penalty, he was spared. And this may be the first time you can actually point to his most powerful asset. This man was very charismatic. People liked him. They admired him. They looked up to him. He had it, with a capital I-T. He had a deep gravitas. So it is very easy to see how a judge might look at a young Pancho Villa and spare his life. Instead of executing him, they sent him to the army. It's not uncommon back then. The dictator Diaz used to hire bandits in order to fulfill a very specific role in the military. And that role was to take them from one area of the country where they knew everybody and send them to another area where they don't know anybody and have them brutalize that population, which they did, which he did. And if you think about it, it makes sense. Hire killers and thieves to terrorize local peasants and anyone who's protesting. And if those hired killers and thieves encounter bandit gangs who are also themselves killing and thieving, well, then go ahead and arrest them and bring them into your army. They can't continue doing what they're doing in their home state because they know people, but instead send them to another part of the country and put them to work. It worked, sort of. If your goal is to terrorize the 90% of the population who are barely surviving, well, it's a pretty good plan. But Pancho doesn't like it. And although we really don't have a lot of records, we do know that he had an kind of an internal moral code, and he hated being told to slaughter the peasants, so he leaves the army. At one point, he was ordered to kill everyone in a village, and instead, he killed the officer who had given him that order, stole his horse, and fled back to northern Mexico. And that is where he actually adopts the name Pancho Villa, which he said was his grandfather's name, who had also been a bandit. Maybe that's true, maybe it's not. We do know, as a side note, his friends called him La Cucaracha, the cockroach. It's a term of endearment, although one I don't fully understand. So when he's back in northern Mexico, he starts gathering friends and supporters, other bandits, other outlaws. He becomes popular, locally powerful, and somewhat infamous. A few years pass, and around 1908, 1909, his life changes. Pancho Villa meets a guy named Abraham Gonzalez. Abraham was a very wealthy hacienda owner, although not one of the bad ones, and he was part of this now emerging movement where some of the wealthy people were saying that the Diaz regime has gone way too far, there's got to be reform, this is a dictatorship, it's becoming horrible, and we have to oppose this man. So Abraham talks to Pancho Villa and tells him that you should oppose Diaz, but you can do this just by being a bandit, by being who you are. Just hit the people that need hitting and help the people that need helping. It's not really bad advice, really. Pancho Villa wholeheartedly believes this guy, buys into it. And Abraham is working for Francisco Madero, who I will talk about later. Pancho Villa takes it to heart that he can use his banditry, use his lack of a strict lawful code, but the existence of his own personal moral code to help the people. And this is where he actually starts to become the Robin Hood of Mexico. He's literally giving money and giving things to the poor. He's generating goodwill by robbing from the rich, or at least the rich that were Diaz supporters, and giving to the poor. He now fits the mold of a gentleman bandit, the kind that is a common myth. It crops up all over the world, and occasionally it's even true, like here. He has allied himself with Madero and some of the other ultra wealthy landowners who are pushing for reform. Now, would they be on the same side if not for Diaz? No, almost certainly not. But war makes for strange bedfellows, and the enemy of my enemy is my friend. They aren't actually on the same side. They're just fighting against the same guy. Which may not be an important distinction now, but believe me, it is later. So Pancho Villa becomes the Robin Hood of Mexico. And he's driven by the guy who is the supporter of Madero, who I will talk about later. But before I talk about Madero, we're going to go south to talk about Emiliano Zapata. Zapata was a true revolutionary. He was not a bandit that turned into a revolutionary or a folk hero. He was not an educated man thinking about enlightenment and reform. He was not a very wealthy man who had never done a day's work in his life seeking to change the regime. No, Zapata was a working man that rose up. Eventually. Pancho Villa is in the north, and Emiliano Zapata is in the south. And where Zapata lives was subject to the rather more extreme examples of the abuse that the landowners were inflicting on the peasants. It's not the absolute worst treatment of the peasants. That was in the Yucatan Peninsula, where whole villages were killed off if they refused to work for the rich, or literally children were killed because their parents were trying to grow food instead of growing a cash crop that the local landowner could sell. That would be henequen, and I did cover that in a previous episode. So, where Zapata lived, the treatment of the peasants was bad, although not quite as bad. But what they did have worse than everywhere else in Mexico was land theft. And the reason for that is simple, because they were living in the area that had an abundance of rich land. So this had been going on for about 100 years in little bits and pieces. But under Diaz, it became exponentially worse. And it is very simple. This is not a complex con. The hacienda owners, that would be the haciendas being the very large plantation-like farms. So when I say a hacienda owner, I mean an extraordinarily wealthy man who owns a huge amount of land. The hacienda owners had all the money, and the way they would get more land is by simply stealing it. They would pay soldiers, mercenaries, strongmen, or bandits to beat the peasants into submission. Peasant families would simply be told, "This is our land now." And it did not matter if that family had been farming there for a century or three or ten. It just didn't matter. It didn't matter if the recorded land ownership was very clear and documented and going back all the way to the Spaniards when they first took over hundreds of years ago. It doesn't matter. Now, the hacienda owner says, "Well, this is mine." He puts a fence around it, and there's some guys with guns saying, "This is our land now, go away." Or, much more frequently, "This is our land now, but you're still going to work it, starting now, so get to work." This type of abuse is just sickening. It really is. There was an event in Zapata's childhood that shaped his view of the world. His little village, and this is a very small village, had an orchard that was communally owned. It's kind of a common land, and everyone was growing fruit trees. Everyone pitched in to maintain these trees. It is a very agrarian community, so everyone knows what to do. The trees are maintained by the people that live in the village. Frequently, children are told by their parents they've got to go, you know, prune the trees or fertilize the trees or water the trees. And then once a year, they have the big harvest, and the families would all get a share of the fruit. They would have a big feast, and then the excess would be sold off, maybe a third to a half, depending on how big the harvest was. The town itself would then have the money to make minor improvements to the roads or the aqueducts or the buildings or the church. It's not a lot of money, but it is enough to keep the village prosperous. And one day, as a young man, Emiliano Zapata saw his father crying and weeping. Why? Because the local hacienda owner had simply put a fence around the orchard and said it was theirs, and if you complain, you're dead. The town does not get any fruit, the families don't get their share of the fruit, and you, Emiliano, don't get to have any fruit unless you want to buy it from the landowner. The hacienda owner will take all of the fruit at harvest and keep all of the money. And as a young man, Zapata saw the silver lining. Huh? He wouldn't have to work in the orchard anymore, right? Right? No. You still have to keep working. And if something still needs to be done, you have to do it. And they won't pay you. And if you complain, you're dead. And while you're working there, don't take any of the fruit. Because if you take any of the fruit, you're dead. It is abhorrent. What they did was absolutely disgusting, truly vile. And it is easily understandable why this drove the most important issue of the revolution, land reform. Zapata was fairly uneducated, although his father, as a decently successful farmer in the area, did teach him kind of a rudimentary bookkeeping and simple math at a very, very low level reading so that he could actually be successful in the agricultural trade business. So not a learned man, but definitely more educated than his peers in that part of Mexico. So a few years later, when it happened again, another hacienda simply walled off a huge portion of land, not a small orchard, but a massive, massive stretch, and said, "This is ours now." Zapata got involved. There were many of the local peasants that were calling for violence, and Emiliano Zapata said, "No, we're not going to do that. What we're going to do is go to Mexico City, and we will talk to Diaz." So they gathered up a little bit of money, and they hired a lawyer, not a top-notch lawyer, a very low-level guy, and they go to Mexico City, and they they actually obtain an audience with the dictator. And they explain to Diaz that this land did not belong to the Hacienda, that it had never belonged to the Hacienda, and that it has simply been stolen. And this cannot be legal. There is, we have records going back centuries that the land is not theirs. And they have never paid anyone for the land. They have simply stolen it. We are asking Diaz to intervene on their behalf. Diaz was aghast. He was shocked. Oh, my gosh. How could this possibly have happened? I promise you, I will have this looked into immediately, and I will deal with you favorably, and I agree with your position. Rest assured, my young friends, I will support you in this. You have found an ally. Diaz then dismissed them, and as soon as he dismissed them, as soon as they were out of his sight, he had them arrested and thrown in prison, because Diaz didn't care. Diaz truly did not care that the ultra-wealthy were just stealing the land. His base of support was the ultra-wealthy, who were stealing the land from the peasants. Everything the man did was to further the wealth and power of a tiny, tiny, tiny number of individuals, and this was just another one of them. When he was confronted with outright theft and very clear and obvious case that is cannot be ignored, he simply ignored it. Justice didn't matter, truth didn't matter, reality didn't matter, but only thing that mattered was that his supporter in the area was the Hacienda, and the Hacienda takes the land, and he's just going to back the Hacienda. It didn't matter. And we are not talking about something like eminent domain or when you're forced to sell something to someone else. They weren't being paid. They literally just took it. And if you complain, you're dead. So Diaz throws them in prison. He's going to teach them a lesson. And it did not have the effect that Diaz intended. This may have been the point where Zapata actually became a revolutionary. But he's not executed. He's actually sent to the army, where he is exposed to horse training. And it turns out he's got a real knack for this, a real talent. He's a very, very good one. Some people have gifts that are different than others, and this was his. So when he leaves the military, when he leaves the army, he goes back to his home state and he ends up actually making quite a bit of money for the horse owners, middle class money, not upper class money. And he's doing this by becoming a horse trainer for the ultra wealthy Hacienda owners, the ones that have been stealing all the land. And that is Emiliano Zapata. Now, the third character that we're going to look at is Francisco Madero. Francisco Madero was not a peasant revolutionary or a bandit or an anarchist or an organizer or a communist. He was the son of one of the richest families in the country. And it's a damn good thing he was, because if he hadn't been, well, then this would not have developed in the way that it did. But we'll get to that. Of all of the early intellectuals that were trying to change Mexico at the time, at this point, he stood head and shoulders above all of them, although not literally, because he was only 5'1". He was one of those extremely wealthy people that happens to be interested in social change. And I'm not knocking that. I'm really not, because there is a long and storied history in many, many different countries around the world of men and women who have wealth and the means to sit down and study things and think about them. And they are frequently the individuals that end up driving change. In fact, I very much want to do an episode on one of the more famous ones in English history, a man named William Wilberforce, who was absolutely instrumental in getting the slavery abolished in the British Empire. But that is another story and will be told another time. All right, Francisco Madero in Mexico actually practiced what he preached. He was not just a guy that was thinking about these reforms in the abstract and ignoring them in his own life and ignoring them in his own land, because that was what was actually making his family money. No, he actually introduced these reforms on his own land and on his family's lands, where he could actually convince them and where he had some influence. Now, it may seem like these things are commonplace now, but back then, it was revolutionary. Get it? His ideas are revolutionary? Sorry. Okay. He actually spoke to his workers. He learned their names. He paid them more than anyone else in the going rate around at the time. When times were bad, he kept paying them so that they could survive, even if it came at his own personal loss. Part of that was because he realized that it would be better to have his workers survive than to starve to death or turn to banditry. He gave them medical care and established and funded schools for the children of the workers. Now, that one in and of itself, that was a really big deal. Education is rather important to having a better life and to learning useful skills. So for him to assist the children of the workers in doing so was rather uncommon. It was actually extremely rare, and it was rather revolutionary. Among the other landowners, they were not only not doing this, they were actively blocking any efforts to educate the people. The largest landowner in all of Mexico, a guy that personally owned or had stolen 7 million hectares of land. That is 27,000 square miles of land is what this one guy owned or had stolen. And he actually specifically said to the people that were trying to establish schools in his land, "I don't need lawyers, I need field hands." And if you do remember that the previous episodes, the hacienda owners had near dictatorial control over what happened in their own borders. So if they said no schools, then there were no schools, with the exception of some religious and Catholic schools, because although they had a huge amount of power, that power did not extend to controlling the Catholic Church within their own borders. And as a slight side note, when we were talking about the war for Mexican independence, I said that the big three groups were the wealthy, the peasants, and the Catholic Church. That's not the case this time. The Catholic Church doesn't really have a huge amount of influence at this point. There are three groups, but they are the wealthy, the peasants, and the military. Anyway, so that's Madero. He's a well-meaning landowner, a very small man with giant ideas and huge ambition, and one other crucial quirk. He was hugely superstitious, like radically so. Not religious, he was not a big Catholic, just very, very superstitious. Madero actually believed that the spirits were speaking to him, like literally, not metaphorically, and not quietly or through signs, no. He had actual conversations with the voices in his head. Now, what is the difference between that and a guy on the street talking to himself? Money, family, wealth. So according to Madero, he had spoken to his dead brother and another member of his family, at least one and probably more. And these spirits had specifically told him that he had a mission. He had a destiny. He had a purpose. And he was going to save Mexico. So it's the spirits. It's not God. This is by no means a Christian thing. Otherwise, the Catholic Church would have been involved. It is not a Christian or Catholic thing. It is his just spirits. So the spirits that he had been talking to had entrusted him with a mission for the good of the country. He said that you've got to stop working in the fields. So he did. And then they said, you've got to stop eating. So he did. And so he was starving. And he had a vision after a week or so of starvation. And in this vision, his dead brother told him that a great burden weighs upon your shoulders. You have accepted a monument as mission that this year is going to become the base of your political career. Since the book you are going to write will be the standard that your citizens will judge you, and it will be the measure that will delineate your full length and the one that reveals to the Union who you are, what your ideals, your aspirations, your aptitude, and your means of combat are. It's a rather specific prediction, but when it really boils down to it, it's that you're going to write a book. And that absolutely did come true. The rest of the prediction that he would change the entire course of the history of Mexico, yeah, that happened too. that he would be very, very successful and have a long and storied career. That didn't. I guess the spirits messed up the middle and the end. So that was in June of 1908. And in 1909, he actually published a book called The Presidential Succession of 1910. And that is where the story of the Mexican Revolution actually kicks off. That I realize that I'm a half hour into this, but this is a wonderful, albeit complex, little story. It is complex. A bit. So, to start talking about the Great Revolution beginning in 1910, we've got to go back to 1908. It happened because of what Madero was reading. This is actually why he got that quote-unquote message from beyond. It was because of what he was reading. And it's not a secret thing. He was reading what everyone else in Mexico was reading. And if you couldn't read, it was being read to you. This shocked the country. It was an interview. Seriously. A softball interview that was designed to kiss the butt of the dictator, to suck up to Diaz, to flatter him. There were no hard questions, only praise from a very sycophantic American journalist. That journalist was a guy named James Creelman. That's why it's called the Creelman Interview. In 1908, the dictator Diaz gave him and granted him an interview. And so he's doing this for a magazine called Pearson's Magazine, which was rather famous in America at the time. The title of the interview was Porfirio Diaz, Hero of the Americas. This interview was absolutely just BS to an extreme degree. There's a line in it that says, and this is a direct quote, "There is no more real, more romantic, or heroic figure in all the world than the soldier statesman whose adventurous youth pales in the pages of Dumas." Pure nonsense. Dumas was the author of The Three Musketeers and The Count of Monte Cristo. The 80-year-old dictator was not a dashing swordsman fighting for his country, nor was he a brilliant man who had been unjustly imprisoned for 14 years. Diaz was the guy doing the imprisoning. So that's the level of BS we're dealing with. Creelman says he's a hero whose, again, quote, "iron rule has converted the warring, ignorant, superstitious, and impoverished masses of Mexico, oppressed by centuries of Spanish cruelty and greed, into a strong, steady, peaceful, debt-paying, and progressive nation." He forgot to mention that Diaz was actually a dictator whose ferocity had repressed any opposition, and that the centuries of oppression of under Spanish cruelty and greed was really nothing compared to what was now happening under Diaz. Sure, it's not Spanish cruelty, but it is considerably worse. But that's not the shocking part. That's normal. It's awful, but it's normal. When you interview a dictator, you have to kiss their butt and lie about how horrible they are. And if you don't do that, you don't get the interview. It still happens today. Just look at Vladimir Putin. So Creelman, possibly by accident, actually did ask something that was really, really important. And Diaz gave an actual answer. So the question was, what's going to happen after you? He was actually asking, well, you know, what happens after you die? But Diaz didn't answer it like that. He treated it as if the question was, what's going to happen at the end of your political career, not the end of your life? So instead of talking about who his successor would be, he pretended like the end of his political career was going to be when he steps down. The weird part is we don't really know if he meant this or not. It's possible that he was just giving the same BS to the man who was flattering him and sucking up to him, and that he really didn't think about what he was saying, and that he was just kind of playing it up to this noble leader facade that he was putting forth. And maybe this Creelman idiot was just eating it up wholeheartedly. We don't really know. Maybe he meant it, maybe he didn't. But it doesn't actually matter, because what he actually said was, "I would welcome an opposition party. If it appeared, I will see it as a blessing and not an evil." And if it can develop power, not to exploit, but to rule, I will stand by it, support it, advise it, and forget myself in the successful inauguration of complete and democratic government of the country. That's the bomb. He's saying that any opposition party would be encouraged. There had been no opposition party for 30 years. It didn't exist. He had ruthlessly, thoroughly oppressed them. And I mean arresting anyone protesting or even complaining. I mean taking people that write books critical of a dictatorship and throwing them in prison for years or maybe indefinitely. I mean closing down newspapers and shooting journalists. I mean making sure that every single word printed about him was a positive one. Not allowing freedom of the speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, anything. And certainly not allowing anyone to actually run against him. There was no opposition party. It didn't exist. And then all of a sudden, in 1908, he does an interview where he says he would welcome it. And when this interview gets published, it goes off like a bomb in Mexican society. People were just asking the obvious question. Did he actually mean this? And then the next question is, well, if he did mean this, what's going to happen? Well, I will tell you what's going to happen. It doesn't matter if he actually meant it. The people were going to act on it. And they did. Dozens, hundreds of people stepped forward saying that they were going to run for office. And not the presidency. I'm talking about like the bottom portions, the equivalent of the local city councilman, all the way from the very bottom, all the way up to the governorships and then to the presidency. There were these little political parties that started to spontaneously form all over Mexico. And this happened so quickly that Diaz was a little bit overwhelmed. And Zapata in the South was one of those that very immediately formed a little political party just to kind of see what would happen. Put forth a candidate or two just to see what would happen. And when they weren't shot or thrown in prison, Zapata realized that the time had come. And that's when he rose to be a true revolutionary. And it was at Diaz's basically his invitation. In the North, that's when Abraham went to Pancho Villa and said, look, we really need you. Be the bandit hero that you are. Step up. Let's do it. And he did. All of this happened so quickly that Diaz was a little bit overwhelmed. And anyone receiving criticism for taking these steps forward would then point to the interview as proof and evidence that he would tolerate this, that he would support their new opposition party. So the powers that be are then turning to the president, turning to the dictator, to Diaz. Well, what are you going to do? You got to tell us what to do because we need orders. And Diaz has a choice. He either has to say, no, I didn't actually mean this. Everybody dies. Or he's got to own up to it. He's got to hold on to it. And he's got to let them do it. And so that's what he did. He let them do it. That is why Francisco Madero got his quote-unquote message from the spirits, that he should write a book about the transition in 1910 and that he was personally destined to be the next president of Mexico. So in the spring and summer of 1910, all across Mexico, the people are rising within the framework of an election. Emiliano Zapata in the South. In the North, Pancho Villa was working with Abraham, who was supporting Madero, who was himself running for the presidency. And I'm going to finish that in the next episode. I realize that this is just a kind of a big, big, big buildup, but I promise you, all of the action begins in the next episode, and it lasts for two episodes. And in order to understand it, you had to understand those three people, who they were, where they came from, and what they were really doing. And now that the background is out of the way, now that the stage has been set and the table has been laid, the second episode will be coming soon. I promise you it will be a good one. I promise you war. I promise you banditry and train robbery. I promise you betrayal, glorious cavalry charges, and doomed battles. I promise you fallen heroes, shattered dreams, and what has got to be the single worst and most evil American ambassador in the entire history of the United States. I promise you wrongs darker than death or night. I promise you strawberry soda, vanilla ice cream, and tourists buying postcards depicting the battle that they just watched while sitting on tops of hotels drinking cocktails. I also promise you that this won't take long. The next episode will be up in about 2 weeks.
Storied History is written and recorded by Charles Chestnut in New Orleans, Louisiana, with audio production and original music by Seamus O'Connor. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, and we'll see you soon.